So let's first sort of start and kind of remind us of where we're at, because today is going to be very different from yesterday, because I'm trying to get you through 700 years of stuff in a couple days, right? And so yesterday, what was the core argument? It was that paying developers is expensive, right? We all know that. We saw the data on that. We only looked at it from the U.S. perspective, but it's clearly expensive there. It's probably expensive everywhere, anywhere where they develop or invent things. In addition to that, we also know and established that using the programming languages is part of that expense, right? And it varies by the product that people use. We saw that from the Google study, right? We also saw that even though we wouldn't expect the actual programming language design to be necessarily all of the cost, obviously not. There's lots of things that influence cost. We also saw that there was cases where we know that it varied by product, like the Google study, and we saw cases where minor problems of the language design really expensive, like the Y2K problem, right? With Y2K, the problem was that it took, what was it, almost 2 to 3 years of the entire U.S. workforce to fix that issue just because of a small flaw in the language. That's a really big deal. That's hundreds of billions of dollars, right? Very expensive to fix. After we established that, we looked and we said, well, why is that the case that there's these variations across these products that we even build these things? And as it came out, we discovered that, in practice, computer scientists have not really been gathering very much data, right? And so they're kind of just guessing. So you might think that everyone is an expert if they have a PhD or something or in a position of authority, but in fact, we also saw evidence from Altadwy and Brown that actually not so much. People often believe themselves to be experts, but when you measure what they believe compared to facts, it's a very different thing, right? And that's important because what it tells us is as experts or as we gain expertise, we might be tempted to think we are right. But in fact, we need to boil our opinions down to facts, not just what we believe, right? And we need to disambiguate those two things. Make sense? And that's kind of where we left off. Is there any questions about yesterday? Or do you kind of get that core argument?
Well, there is the... There could be the problem that sometimes what is fact is subject. That it doesn't matter what other people think.
And this is the subject of today. What are facts? Right? But we did talk about a lot of facts. We just didn't talk about how we know whether or not those things are sort of legitimate, right? Okay. But is there other questions about the stuff we talked about yesterday before we move on? Okay, cool. So over the next couple days, we're going to do a couple different things. Today, the purpose is to establish how we know whether things are facts, right? What does that mean? And what it means is not simple. I'm not going to lie to you. It's not like you flip a switch and it becomes a fact. It's a very complicated thing that humans in other scientific disciplines have worked really hard to try and figure out when we can call something fact-based or evidence-based. And what that has meant has actually changed over time. So today, what we're going to do is in the morning, we're going to talk about, you know, everything that you need to know from before the 20th century. Which is a lot, and I'm leaving out a ton, but it'll get you started. After that, in the afternoon, I'm going to try to bring you up to speed on everything after the 20th century. After the 1900s, so right after the cutoff. And there's even more, and I have to leave out an absolute ton because it involves changes to the legal system, significant changes to how we view ethics, changes to how we do all sorts of stuff. And it's complicated. It involves specific laws that have changed and things like that, all sorts of stuff. Because believe it or not, there were some points in time where scientists were not actually acting like scientists. And congressional bodies had to step in and say, no, you have to actually gather data. And they were like, no, we don't want to. It's complicated. But so this morning, before the 20th century, this afternoon after. And the difference between them is stark, to say the least. And not Tony Stark. Okay. So while we're doing that, we're also going to keep doing this pattern where we kind of do a lecture, interactive lecturers type thing. And then we're going to start building our experiments. But over the next couple days, we're going to try to get to the point where we're actually building tangible tasks for us all to try so that we can actually get to the point where we can do an experiment with each other on Friday and then do analysis of it. Now, granted, keep in mind, we're doing this in a couple days at light speed. Generally speaking, you can go a lot slower than this, but it'll give you the idea, right, on how you do it. Okay, so let's sort of take a step back and let's ask ourselves kind of what's happened in science over the last 500 years. In general, science has become increasingly empirical. So let me ask you that first. What does that mean? Science has become increasingly empirical. What does that mean? You know the term? I don't know if it's like it's an English thing or if you just haven't heard it, so either is fine. My students sometimes in English don't often know either, so.
Well, I mean, that sentence is not trivial because does there exist empirical without interpretation?
True, yeah, it can mean several things, but what do you think it means?
That they want to rely more on like observations and measurements.
Observations and measurements, that's exactly right. Why? We'll talk about that objective thing a little bit. Although, actually, historically, that's kind of backwards, but it sounds like it shouldn't be. We found that out accidentally. What do you think? What do you think it means for the science to become increasingly empirical? In your own words.
I think so too. It's like it's based on the observations, and I think this method has been for 100 years for people. They just see something and make some hypotheses on this and some conclusions. And this is what's the empirical method like.
Okay. Other opinions? Is that it with your point of view or no?
For example, when I talk about empirical researchers, we mean why we start to use it, because it's like an idea that our mind can lie to us. So that's why we need to base our knowledge not in our mind but in the real world, and we need to take connections or something like this in outer world, but not in something that possess to us, but something to possess the real world around us.
That's good. That's really good. Oh, I like all three of your answers. That's good. So we're going to be talking about sort of what that means, and like I said, it's not trivial, right? It's not just I go observe something and I write it down. That's really not what empirical science is today. Right? I mean, there is some of that happens, but there's problems with that. Notably, if you just observe something and write it down, the biggest issue is it lacks checks and balances that have been shown over time to prevent things like fraud, which was rampant in science for centuries. Right? And so what we're going to talk about is part of the history of evidence gathering, because a lot of these things that we take for granted in empirical science, like, for example, how many of you have heard of control groups? Okay. These did not happen because scientists were like, we want these things. These happened in part because oftentimes somebody committed fraud. And they're like, well, how do we prevent that kind of fraud? In that particular case, it was homeopathy. And also mesmerism, but I'll get to it. And a lot of these issues became either scandals or they led to death or other very serious consequences. So whenever I give this lecture, and I apologize up front, sometimes this stuff is icky, right? Icky meaning gross. I've attempted to make it PG. In the United States, that means like relatively not gross. But sometimes there are some parts of history that are not pleasant, and that's reality. But it's good to confront reality because it's real, right? So, like I said, I've tried to make it friendly so that it's not like, you know, I'm not putting in terrible pictures of people dying and stuff. But nonetheless, sometimes it happens, and if you're squeamish about it, just be aware. Close your eyes for a minute, you know, if you have to. And I've mostly focused on methodology. Okay, and so we will talk about this in the context of how we build our own experiments, too. And so the first thing actually gets back to your point. What was your name again?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this idea of subjectivity. Right? Subjectivity was effectively the only way that you did science, or what we thought was science, or what may have been called scientific-ish, for a very long time. Right? Even in early studies, where, quote-unquote, studies, where they, quote-unquote, gathered data, a lot of the ways in which they gathered the data was quite subjective. So, for example, one of the early studies that is well-known is by a guy named James Lind. Hear this study? Anybody heard this? Basically, there was a disease that they called at the time something called scurvy, and it caused problems. Well, it killed you. And this fellow named James Lind, he eventually came up with a procedure, which was wrong, but that's not the point, to try to diminish this particular disease, and he sort of accidentally found something that helped and then came to the wrong conclusions, but never mind all that. The point was, what he ended up doing as part of a study was sort of documenting little details. But a lot of the details he documented, even though some people consider it to be a study, were very subjective. And I want to talk about three things related to subjectivity. Number one is just our perception. Number two is how we communicate with each other. And number three, the issue of like intentional or unintentional bias. So first, let's look at the concepts of perception. And we can do that in many ways, but a simple way is just through a box. Right? With a box, when you're drawing in 3D, you can perceive the box's front to be either way. Either that's in the back, or and it's concave, or that is in the front and then it's pushing out. In this particular case, one particular perception isn't wrong or right. It just is a different perception. And you might see it either way. Now, there's a million examples of this that we could use, but most of them are under copyright, and that's not. And as such, that's why that example's there. But as it happens, it turns out that perception is actually more pernicious than this. For example, there is a study by a fellow named Prophet, and what they did was they basically wanted to see how well people understood the concept of distance. Like, can you gauge distance? Subjective. I mean, you know, can you tell how far apart something is? When we think of distance, we might think of, we measure it. But can humans just tell? Like, can we use our experience and just get a pretty good guess? And it turns out that even tiny differences in what's going on with you as an individual can impact that. So, for example, if you wear a backpack, it changes your perception of distance. Why? I don't know, but it does. And so we have to be really careful when we just perceive something and write it down. Because what is coloring our own perception of the event can impact how we do the science. Does that make sense? That's pretty straightforward, right? Not icky. Boxes are not icky. Now, in addition, in science, we often have to communicate our perceptions to each other. So we can have flawed perceptions, but we also have to tell them to each other. I had to describe, for example, these boxes, and you may or may not have had the same idea I did as I was describing it. Right? And that could be my lack of perception or your lack of understanding. I mean, sorry, my lack of communicating, my extreme jet lag, or your lack of understanding, either way. Problem is that oftentimes with communication, there's all sorts of weird flaws that happen. Number one is communication can sometimes convince you of things, right? Even if they're not true. In addition, it turns out we can manipulate each other to even do things like plant false memories in each other. And there are known techniques for doing this. And they're actually, where do you think that they're often used the most? It's sort of silly, but it's true. Advertising. Right? So there's this really clever study done by Braun, Ellis, and Loftus. And by the way, all the citations are at the bottom of these slides, so you can go look them up if you want to. Although that one's a little hard to read. But. And what they did, they noticed that in advertisements, it would sort of play on people's nostalgia. Right? You know the word. And so they then asked people to report about a trip to Disneyland. I assume that Disneyland is known, even in Finland. You don't have a Disneyland. There's like a Disneyland Paris, right? I don't think there's a Disneyland Finland, is there? Disneyland Russia? I have no idea. But you know what I'm talking about, right?
Dream about it, of course.
Yeah, Mickey Mouse, blah, blah, blah. And then what they did is they then showed people or didn't show people an advertisement. And they were either told in that advertisement or implied that they either met Mickey Mouse or Bugs Bunny. Okay, and the reason they did that is because while Mickey Mouse, you might have met a character while you were there. That character might have been Mickey Mouse, but would not have been Bugs Bunny because Disney doesn't own the copyright to Bugs Bunny. Right? So you wouldn't have met Bugs Bunny there. However, when they actually then measured whether people actually had a memory of that event, they found that seeing the advertisement with the fake thing that the researchers literally just made up caused people to think that they had an experience with Bugs Bunny at Disneyland. There was a statistical correlation. Only because they basically showed them some pretty little advertisements. They sort of caused people to think things that were wrong. Now this is tricky, right? Because like as scientists, we want to think, well, we're trying to be objective, you know? We're trying to like root out these kind of problems and write stuff down that's fair. But in fact, we're very susceptible to tiny things in our environment. And so we often need checks and balances in experiments to avoid these kinds of minor problems. They help us root out the causes of problems as opposed to influences. So issues of communication can be a big problem. Oh, there's one other that's interesting. I don't have any clue in China how the justice system works in Finland. But in the United States, oftentimes for a long time, they would rely on something they called an expert witness to an event. So if someone was like killed or there was a crime of some kind, they would say, well, did you see the crime? And then they would say, yes, I did. Was it that person over there? And it turns out this is actually horribly unreliable. Witnesses, unfortunately, have been shown to be not very reliable in court. That's a big problem. Because just because someone says they saw something, it turns out doesn't actually mean it's true. So you want external evidence. It's tricky. And worse than that, in fact, it's even easier to intentionally trick people. Like I already mentioned this communication issue. However, most of us have probably heard of issues of things like propaganda, something we actually see a lot of in the United States right now because of Donald Trump. I mean, it's true, right? The intentional use of propaganda to manipulate the populace. Certainly, we've seen propaganda in Russia. We've seen propaganda in Germany, many other places. This is not unknown to people across Earth. But the point is, the intentional use of fraud can also influence people when they're making decisions. So in science, we have to sometimes defend against the intentional use of fraud. And this is actually trickier, because this implies some kind of like a verification of claims. Right? Doesn't it? Someone makes a claim, and then we have to say, well, how do we know that that claim is true? Because this has been so common. Not just political stuff, but in science too. Scientists are not exceptions. They do commit fraud. This has happened many times before and is well documented in the academic literature, unfortunately. And sometimes, you know, I say fraud, but sometimes scientists don't even know they're doing it. They just really believe something and are spreading a message, even though it's actually BS. Okay, yeah. So here's a little example. There's a paper by Wolfwork, Castellan, and Brooks. And this one's sort of a funny one. They basically wanted to know, you know, like Coke and Pepsi, I assume you have both Coke and Pepsi, and some people weirdly debate whether one is better than the other. The answer, by the way, is neither. They're both gross, but that's not the point. I mean, that's not the answer. That's just my subjective opinion. But so what they did is they tried to trick people, and they basically put the reverse labels on them, and they asked them which one they prefer, and then they asked them the preferences. And not shockingly, if you say you prefer Coke and the label says Coke, even if it's actually Pepsi, you prefer actually the opposite, on average. And this experiment has actually been done under a lot of contexts. In Germany, because it's Germany, they of course did it with beer, right? And the same type of result is found. I'm sure there's others besides beverages, but when my co-author and I were writing some of these slides, we were mostly just having fun looking up studies on beer, but never mind that. You get the idea. It's possible to manipulate results if you want to. And so as scientists, we have to be aware that that can occur, and we have to explicitly defend against it with procedures. And scientists had figured this out by mostly the late 17th century. I'm sorry, 18th century. So the late 1700s was when we started to really figure this out. Before that time, it's not that people didn't realize this could occur. It's that they didn't really do anything about it. Nothing really substantive. There are cases where they kind of experimented and tried a little bit, but nothing really definitive. Okay, now, before we go on, what I want to do is I want to take another one of our little breaks, spend 3 to 5 minutes or so, and I want to talk about any claim you can think of that's subjective, that has been made ever by someone you can think of, either a language designer, they make claims all the time, something from a textbook you've read. I mean, you look at the textbooks on language design, they make tons of claims without evidence, right? Tons. Think of any claim that you think is subjective about language design. Just a claim you've heard, and try to decide whether or not it's a subjective claim or a claim that is based on something more. And again, you don't know what something more really means yet. We haven't talked about it. But intuit it. Try to figure out like whether you think it's just a subjective thing. Does that make sense? So first you have to come up with a claim, and then you have to figure out whether or not it's really a fact, like whether there's evidence to support it, or whether or not it's just kind of someone's belief, an anecdote, if you will. Okay, so 3 minutes. Let's do that.
My idea for
reject it or not. One minute left.
Yes, even when they don't need it.
I'm sure you can play it.
I
just want
to
all right, let's go ahead and cut it off. Okay, now let's just do the usual. We're just going to do one per group and make it no more than a sentence or two at most. I just want to hear the claim and whether it's subjective. So let's start here. Hey, guys. Hello. Go ahead.
R is better than Python for statistical analysis.
Okay, and is that subjective or not?
It is subjective.
Why?
Because it's both can be used in the same functionality.
Well, but what makes it subjective?
What makes it subjective is because I've heard also an opposite claim.
Well, opposition doesn't necessarily make it subjective, but it's a tricky question. I'm just trying to make you think about it. We'll talk about it. Go ahead.
The claim is that functional programming and object-oriented programming are essentially the same thing.
Okay. And is that subjective or not?
It's subjective.
What makes it subjective?
I think you could claim that all programming targeting times are the same with that thing.
And with the same, too, we have to be a little careful because there is some mathematics behind these languages. So you might be able to make them functionally equivalent. And, of course, we know you can, right? Because they're all Turing complete. So, but then we have to decide what does the same mean. But in any case, that's good. This group?
Well,
if you didn't get one, that's okay.
I made a claim, and it was that Python is slower than C++ or Java. Right.
Okay, is that subjective?
It is because the slower depends on use case.
Well, sort of. What do y'all think? Is that subjective or not? Is the concept of being slower subjective?
It depends on the case.
Hold on. I'm asking them. Is slower subjective? Right. So that's not subjective. However, it is vague because slower can have a context of use. So that's a vague claim, but it's actually not subjective because it's based on something measurable.
Well, I think you could still debate about whether it's subjective or not. Like, because can you take an objective measure about productivity? Like productivity is time.
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll talk about that. Yeah. Go ahead and go to the back.
It's better to pick static type programming languages as first language.
Oh, okay. Right. Now, what would make that subjective? I mean, what is it subjective?
I don't think it's subjective. because it was part of research and they prove it that it's better than they are.
Yes, so in that particular case, you might be able to operationally define better and then test it. So that may not be subjective. I don't know the answer, but that's interesting. Okay, good. But you can see, I think, through this discussion, it's not that anybody's right or wrong. You can see that, like, it's a little tricky to sort of hammer it out, right? Like, how specific does the claim have to be? What does subjective mean, and how do you remove subjectivity? Like, the instinct I think people have is, well, we just will be objective. But in fact, that's actually not what you do, because you would then have to decide what objective means, and that gets tricky. But it's clear that scientists definitely doubted subjectivity, right? So one example of this, and I apologize that this is slightly icky, but it is reality. In the early 1720s in Boston, there was an outbreak of something called smallpox, which killed you, right? It killed you in high proportion. I forget the exact amount, but it was high. If you got smallpox, you were probably dead. And records from the period which we've read are unclear, right? It's hard to know for sure how accurate anything written down in the 1720s really was. You can't know with certainty. But these people were not dummies. They kept records and tried to track what was going on. And the reports from the period estimate that it killed about 400,000 people, so a lot. And Boston wasn't very big at the time either, so this is a very large proportion of the city. And interestingly, there was a fellow at the time named Cotton Mather, and he was interested in basically a claim, where they would basically cut you and then put smallpox in you. It's way ickier than that, but like I said, I'm going for PG. Like, get the pus and literally put it inside you. Yeah, right? You're like, oh, that is icky. Yeah, it's icky. And here's the thing. Mather claimed this would heal you. And people were like, screw you. Right? Understandably. You cut me open and put smallpox in me? No way. It's going to kill me. Mather said, no, it will make you immune to smallpox. And at the time, by the way, if you aren't catching where this is going, this is like the original kind of almost anti-vax debate. Similar, it's not anti-vax because this wasn't a vaccine. This was like actually killing many people, but that's not the point. But it's one of the first times that we can find where this debate sort of happened. And interestingly, they didn't really run a study. They just kind of yelled at each other in the literature. And so, for example, this William Douglas guy, he claimed it was a wicked and criminal practice. Cool. Wicked and criminal. And then Mather claimed, I've read that thousands of lives have been saved by inoculation, and not one of thousands has miscarried, meaning died by it. This is related by wise and learned men who would not have imposed on the world a false narrative. So it's the same type of thing that you see sometimes in the academic literature today. I'm an expert. Why don't you trust me? Right? I am the person that knows. Therefore, I am right, which is always bullshit. Right? Claims must be made with evidence. End of story. It doesn't matter who you are. And in any case, it's fascinating because when you look back historically, what you see is that when evidence kind of takes a side quest, this kind of rhetoric comes out. No, you're wrong. I have more expertise than you. No, you're wrong. You're the wrong kind of expert. Or you don't deeply understand. This kind of stuff is really common. We see this all the time in the literature of history.
What does rhetoric
mean? Which thing? Oh, rhetoric. Words.
Words.
Yeah, people arguing. The banter. Yeah. Now, there's a lot more to the story of smallpox. Eventually, we found out that William Mather was right. It still actually did kill many people, but it killed a lot less, something like an eightfold reduction in death, which is fantastic at the time, right? But nonetheless. And this gets even crazier once you get to homeopathy. Have you heard of this before, homeopathy? What is it? Give it a shot. What is the claim that people make? Oh, that's fine if you want to give it a shot.
You give some kind of herbs and like minimize dose of something to
yeah.
And they're going to heal.
Yeah, so homeopathy was a whole bunch of claims over time. So if you've never read, have any of you have read pseudoscience before, like on purpose? Anyone read any? So there's a fascinating thing that this is an anecdote. This is just by belief. I don't actually know that there's evidence that this is true, but this is just my suspicion from reading a lot of pseudoscience. Oftentimes, when something is pseudoscientific, I observe. It goes like this. They have some wacky pseudoscience theory. Someone's like, hey, that's garbage. That's dumb. And so then, or something bad happens and it hurts people or something. And then so they kind of change their theory and claim it was never really that, or you didn't really understand it. And then it slowly modifies itself over time. Homeopathy was like that. When it first started, there was all these like rituals and all this garbage, and you would put poison in the water and that would cure something else. That's true. No joke. But eventually, like, that would hurt people, duh. And so they would minimize the amount of poison and say, well, okay, it's like that cures like. You know, like if I have a disease that causes pain, then I give you a poison that causes pain and that will cure it. But I dilute it so it's not that much poison. I know that this makes no sense, but welcome to the 1800s, right? This is what was actually argued. And of course you're thinking, well, thank God we got rid of this long ago. Like the UK got rid of homeopathy, what? Anyone know? When did the UK finally ban it? Long ago, right? It was 2 years ago. And you know when it was banned in the US? It wasn't. It's still practiced today. Today! Because some jackhole in Utah made an exemption in the law, I swear to God, that allowed you to basically promulgate the pseudoscience of even homeopathy. Anyway. So, in any case, there was just two guys. One of them was named Frederick Wilhelm von Hoven. He was the anti-homeopathist. And then there was this guy named Reuter. He was a homeopathist. And he actually practiced it. Like, he went around to, like, families, and he would give them homeopathic medicines that he called cures. He would claim that it healed them. And he would conduct observations, which today we think of as placebo, but at the time that concept didn't really exist. Technically, there was some placebo work from the late 1790s that was done by Benjamin Franklin on this thing called mesmerism, but never mind that. It wasn't a commonly known thing, certainly not in Europe. A little bit, but not a whole lot. And so von Hoven wrote this letter, which we actually found, to the local newspapers, like this 30-page rant, calling him like a fraudster. It's like a really bad blog post today where it's like little kids sniping at each other. You fraud, you little huckster bastard. It's kind of like that. That's kind of what the letter's like. And Reuter, who's like, he's like a doctor, right? He's like, dude, von Hoven was really old at the time. He's like, you're just old. You don't get it. You don't have any expertise. You're old and you're dumb. And his letter was actually, ironically, Reuter's letter was a lot more respectful than von Hoven. But von Hoven was sitting there thinking like, well, God, you're committing fraud on people. In any case, you might think, too, this is just a weird problem with medical history, but it's not. So here's an example. In the 1970s, the Department of Defense in the United States actually held a meeting on programming language design. And the reason they did this was because the DoD estimated that it was spending creating software ballpark $3.5 billion a year. And so they're like, hey, that's a lot of money. We want to make sure that this doesn't go to waste. And they were doing it in a whole bunch of programming languages because academics and industry couldn't make up their damn minds. Right? And so what they did, This was before the first study had ever taken place, by the way. First RCT, before 1976. And what they did was they sat there, and you can read the transcript, they just sat and sniped at each other. Exactly the same way as the damned homeopathists. And when you read the transcript, it sure feels similar. Anecdotally, but yes. So, for example, there's a guy named David Grease, and he said, our first speaker talked about having variables which can contain procedure bodies as objects. The question is whether or not it is a reasonable thing to have in the language. That doesn't sound very snipey. He scores respectful. And Ik Baya, I don't actually know who this guy is. I know who David Grease is. It seems to me that forms of abstract data types are now quite well known. I terribly disagree with Grease when he say that encapsulated data types are not yet within the state of the art. Right? And we can, like, argue that they're right or wrong or something. But the point is that the argument was the same. They had some procedure that they thought might be good or bad, and they didn't test it. They just sat and argued about it. The same way that, Mather did in the 1721, and the same way that Bonhoeffer and Reuter did in 1834. It's the same in many ways. And again, it's not lives on the line, it's billions of dollars. It's different, but it's also a little bit lives on the line when you're talking about the Department of Defense. Because, like, if software goes in a tank, that's a big deal. If software goes in a jet, that's a really big deal. Because people can die on either side of that conflict. Get it? Sort of get the point? When you see pseudoscientific stuff, a red flag, it's not proof, but a red flag is that you just see rhetoric. You just see disagreement. You don't see something more than that. It's a red flag. It's not a guarantee, but it's a red flag. Yeah?
One question. Is the definition for pseudoscience clear?
Probably not. Pseudoscience, that's a great question. The definition for pseudoscience probably isn't clear. It's kind of like, okay, again, this is icky, sorry. The Supreme Court of the United States, I forget when it was, some number of years ago, had a court case about pornography, you know what I mean? And they were asked to rule on something related to pornographic stuff. And they were asked, well, how do you define it even? The Supreme Court said, we don't really know, but we know it when we see it. Right? And I sort of feel like pseudoscience is like that. Like, you don't always know at the time that it's pseudoscience, but eventually you might. We know that astrology is pseudoscience today. They may not have at the time. And we know that it's pseudoscience because it doesn't match observations and all these other things. But sometimes people have to be able to have speculative ideas, too, as they're going. Okay, now, the instinct, I think, is to say, well, we're not going to be subjective then, we're going to be objective. We're going to use tangible, objective things. But the problem is, we need to know what that is. And it turns out that that's not really what you do in science. Because objective doesn't mean a single thing. It can mean a bunch of stuff. So what you really do is science began moving from subjectivity to what is often called falsification. And I won't get into the philosophy. I know Auntie Yohani will laugh, but I won't get into the philosophy of it. But the point is, when people make a claim, make that claim specific enough that it can be tested. And it's the test that matters. And that test today has all sorts of properties. I must be able to replicate the test. I must be able to reproduce the test. Stuff like that. And so you must be able to, in these tests, be able to not deny the results. That's critical. And that is objective to a degree. For example, counting things is objective and it has to be part of a test. You know, how many people died in the smallpox stuff? How long does it take to write a program under a certain condition? Measuring things like quality of life metrics, programmer productivity, dollars spent on a project, all those things are sort of potential, right? It's not about objective, it's about testability. And so what we saw when these things were developing, this sort of idea of falsification actually didn't come from Karl Popper. It came long, long before that. And I want to go back to Boston really quick. So one of the things that they did, and they didn't do it right, and this didn't really exist. It wasn't a thing, right? It wasn't like a modern test. But they did sort of like accidentally test this smallpox thing. And so some people received the inoculation, meaning they cut you open and did some stuff. And some of them didn't. Now, the test is horribly unfair, right? Like, it's probably wealthy people that got inoculated. I don't really know. It's probably the friends of Mather that got inoculated. For all I know, the people that got inoculated also, like, you know, were treated better, might have been less in poverty. I mean, who knows? No, we don't really know. But nonetheless, they did some kind of a test, and there was two groups. By today's standards, this is a terrible experiment. Not to mention the fact that people died. But inoculation did reduce it a lot. So altogether, since April 5th, 889 people, of whom 844 died, had had smallpox. This one disease caused more than 3/4 of all the deaths in Boston during the year of the epidemic. During the same period, Boylston inoculated 242 persons with 6 deaths. Think about that. There might be flaws in that sort of procedure, but 844 out of 889 is a hell of a high death rate, and 6 out of 242 is not. Right? I mean, dramatically different in terms of lives saved. That's a test. It's a crappy test, and it's a test where people died. There's all sorts of ethics issues. The sample sizes aren't equivalent. You name it. But you're talking about a situation where people are going to get smallpox naturally. You can't really do that anyway. It's not easy ethically. There's all sorts of challenges with these kind of things. Same is true in language design. Oftentimes, we can't just like say, okay, Microsoft, you're going to switch to Java for a year. It doesn't work that way. Or we're going to swap out one keyword in a language. So you have to make sacrifices and infer based on the best information you can get. But this still isn't easy. And one of the problems we like to call the precision problem. And so basically what this means is, how do you know, once you've got these numbers, like 889 or 844 or 242 and 6, how do you know that that's sufficient amount of evidence to conclude that you're right? Sufficiently right. How do you know? Today we use statistics, but that won't happen until the early 1900s, mostly. And it gets a little bit tricky in software too, because suppose that you have two people and they're like doing a test, let's say to write some software, and you're testing their speed. Well, they're not going to get the same amount of seconds as individuals, right? They're going to take varying lengths of time. So naturally you have something called dispersion. And somehow you have to take that dispersion into account to decide whether or not that's the case. And this actually happened in medical studies in really the early 1800s. There was this fellow named Pierre Charles Alexander Louise, and he was testing bloodletting. You know this idea? It's not a good idea, but it was an idea. Do you know what this is? Basically, there was a pseudoscience theory in the medical sciences for a couple thousand years called the humors, and the details aren't that important, but there was like, they would ascribe medical conditions to like things like black bile, and then they would like, anytime that there was an illness, they'd be like, well, that's the bile acting up, and like stuff like that. And the idea with bloodletting was they would cut you and they would bleed you out, and that would somehow fix something. Now, here's the problem. Alexander Louise, he was like, now hold on. That seems like a subjective claim. I'm going to test this. It's kind of adorable what he did. And then so he actually added a control group. And then he tested bloodletting or not bloodletting people under various conditions. And he realized correctly that this might actually vary by the kind of person. Like if you're old and you're bloodlet, or you're young, right? So he stratified it, which novel for the time. However, the data that he gathered was inconclusive, but the data that he gathered seemed to indicate that the patients that he bloodlet were dying more often than the patients that weren't. But he came to the opposite conclusion. Good times. So the point is, even when people were trying to use evidence, it's really easy to misinterpret data. It's really easy to not really understand exactly what your objective stuff is telling you. And issues of precision, which cause dispersion, make it hard to interpret. That's why today we talk about all these things like p-values and stuff like that. Because it's not perfect, but it's more precise than it was before. Right? Imperfect, but better. And so that's why we have statistics. Now, statistics is a long story, a really long story, and we're not going to get into all the details of it, but we will talk about it on Wednesday and Thursday, and I'll show you how to do it so that you at least have like some passing understanding of like when you're doing a thesis or something, what you do and what you don't. But I will tell you this, if you plan on getting into for a PhD, or I mean a dissertation or a master's thesis, anything related to human factors, you must learn statistics. And the reason I say that is because you cannot understand what is really happening in your data without it. You just can't. These procedures have been around for hundreds of years. They're well known. How to interpret them is known, and they're not trivial. So if you spend a few semesters going through statistical routines and trying to figure them out, it's worth the effort. It's hard, and it's unpleasant, but it's necessary. So in my case, during my dissertation, I think I spent like a year and a half in the psych department just like reading book after book after book after book on experimental design and statistics, because it's the only way you can figure out what's going on. So some of the most advances happened that were early were various tests that they were doing. The earliest was the chi-squared test, to my knowledge, which doesn't really matter what that is, but it was for categorical data. By the early 1900s, people wanted to know whether beer was safe, which is a long story, but of course it's related to beer. And so this guy was working for Guinness, but Guinness wouldn't allow him to publish on it, so he went under the name Student, which is why we have the Student's Tea Test. In any case, it was really about testing beer. The most important advances, though, were mostly made by this guy named Ronald Fisher, who we'll talk about a little bit more later. He was kind of an icky guy in some ways. He believed in things like eugenics. It's not really pretty, but nonetheless, his statistical ideas were revolutionary, and then he systematically misapplied them over his lifetime and then died from cancer after someone proved that it caused it, but never mind. In any case, in software design experiments, we use the same techniques today. They really haven't changed that much in 100 years. A little bit, but not terribly much. You can still use them and apply them. So here's an example of what you might do-ish. Put 120 software developers in a room, randomly assign a problem to them, give them three programming languages, and then use a statistical technique called an ANOVA and see what you get. This is a crappy experiment. I haven't told you anything about it, but I'm trying to give you the real basics. A control condition, something you test, some kind of data that you put out, and then a statistic that gives you a number which tells you whether or not how you should interpret it, or gives you a clue. I'm trying to build that up so that when we get there tomorrow, you don't go nuts. All right, and so the most crucial thing then, one of the most crucial things that ended up happening in prior to the 20th century is this one. That is the Nuremberg Salt Test. The Nuremberg Salt Test is very famous. You should know about it. And it's famous for good reason. What happened was, I told you about these guys, Reuter and Bonhoeffer, right? And they were sitting there sniping with each other a lot until eventually Reuter said, "Screw you, buddy. Test it." And Bonhoeffer was like, "Sure." So what they did is they constructed what they call a trial. This is a literal trial. They would have, like, a jury, right? And these guys hated each other. They just absolutely hate each other. They both were threatening each other, saying they're liars, you're a fraud, screw you, flipping each other off, whatever, basically, right? I mean, that's a way to interpret their letters. They did not trust each other, even though they were both technically scientists. There was no trust. So they needed a way to derive an experiment that lacked the necessity of trust. And they came up with three procedures. And they are still with us today. And are probably the three most fundamental things that you need to take into account when you do an experiment. Fundamental, you must have them. Right? And they are randomization, meaning if you put people in groups, you randomly assign them. Why? What do you think? Why do you need that? Why would these two guys that did not trust each other want the groups to be, you know, homeopathy or not, to be randomized? What do you think?
To prevent the bias in the groups.
Yeah. I'm going to put all the healthy people in the homeopathy group. Screw you, Reuter. Right? That sort of thing. Okay. Randomization is important as an anti-fraud procedure. That's what it's for. Blinding. What is blinding? What is blinding? In the back. The one staring at your computer. What's your name again?
Yeah.
What's blinding, you know? Anybody know?
Well, I can give an example. So if you have to, you're given, for example, a selection of beers, and then you have your own taste, but then you remove the labels so that you don't know which one is the one.
It's kind of like that. The basic idea is that you're not supposed to know what group you're in. And notably, they had their procedure was double blind, meaning they didn't want the patients to know. And they didn't want to know themselves because they didn't trust each other. So they thought they'd like flip the vials and do stuff like that. And ironically, during the Nuremberg Salt Test, someone tried to do that. Someone tried to commit fraud, got caught because of this procedure. So good thing. That's one reason why we still have it. That's blinding. And then control groups, which I think we've already kind of mentioned. You know, you people get the homeopathy, you people don't. You get a placebo. Placebo was not invented at this time, but to my knowledge, it's the first time that it was sort of applied in this way. They used, I think they called them bread pills, but, you know, or something like that. Although one of them was just distilled water, so I forget exactly what their particular placebo was in this case. But nonetheless, they had a form of placebo. They didn't really know that that mattered, but that's what they had. And interestingly, when the study was run, they all got around a bar, they did this stuff, they had people go back and have their ailments. And actually, we've actually found the original data from the Nuremberg Salt Test, and we actually re-ran their numbers using modern statistics. And it's actually quite inconclusive what the result was. But they came to the conclusion that there wasn't enough evidence to confirm that homeopathy was good. But that was inconclusive. And interestingly, when a study's inconclusive, that brings up another question. If it's inconclusive, does homeopathy work or doesn't? Study's inconclusive? Does it work or not? Yeah, so in science today, but not always, in science today, you are guilty until proven innocent. But that didn't change till the early 1900s, which we'll talk about next time. At the time, you were actually innocent until proven guilty for medicine. In fact, you could in the United States, I swear to God, this is true, you could legally kill someone with your medicine until 1938. Yep, it's true. Or 34, somewhere around there. We'll talk about it. It's nuts. Okay. The second thing is, I think this is the last one. Let me double check. I want to make sure we have a little bit of time. Yep, okay, good. This is the last one. I want you to spend 5 minutes in talking about issues of trust in programming language design, how we can protect against it in experiments. So I'll give you a couple examples. How many people have met someone that strongly believes a particular programming language is good or bad? Right. Think that's a problem? Yeah, so there's one issue of trust. See if you can't come up with some others. Take 3 minutes. By the way, that particular one you can get rid of with blinding. Okay, I'm going to cut it off there just because I want to have time to talk about our next stuff. So just very quickly, one sentence or so, what was an issue of trust that you thought of?
We thought of if an institution strongly prefers one type of language, if, again, that institution carries out a study, there might be bias towards
right, perhaps they invented it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If they have some sort of gain from promoting that?
Very good. Excellent. Right. If Microsoft says that C# is excellent, well, of course they would say that because they invented it and they have a profit motive. They don't get paid by it necessarily, but they do. Oh, yeah, with languages, oftentimes if you own the product, you box people into it. And so you have a vested interest in that. Right? Go ahead. Did you come up with one?
No.
Okay. What about you?
I was thinking that if someone is designing a programming language, mm-hmm. then my idea is that they know what they like, and they might know what their friends like, and so, but then they try to cater for others.
Mm.
So how do they cater for others? How do they know other people's preferences?
Right. Maybe that's an implicit bias of just our lack of knowledge of the common case or something. That's interesting. What about in the back? Did you come up with one?
I think simplicity, like me and him are doing also some kind of program or doing something about language, and then I think my design is better and his is better. It should be tested instead of like I'm shouting louder, so mine is better, and then we use it and it could be like that.
Certainly true, but how is that an issue of trust? What is the trust issue there? Oh, I see. Right, that's a good point. I have an example of that. I was at a DARPA conference, which I do not have an NDA for. And there was a group from Google there, right? They were talking about Go. I forget who it was. It doesn't really matter. And there was some, they were getting a lot of flack for Go at the time, for inventing it. These people, one of the inventors was. And somebody in the audience asked, well, what did you do to fix the language to account for that criticism? And he said, I swear to God, this is true. He said, literally nothing. We hired a marketing team. Right? Trust. Or lack thereof. But this is why trust is bad in science, right? You have to guard against trust. When Google says Go is good, you say, did you hire a marketing team? Right? That's the question, in any case. Okay, so just like before, although we don't have tons of time, I want to jump back to our activities. And our goal is to slowly build up experiments with checks and balances embedded into them. And so our first day, we came up with research questions. The second session, we came up with hypotheses. And, oops, the second, I just spell things wrong. And the first one, for today, we're going to say the lecture for this session will focus on design of experiments, how they changed up until the 20th century. We're going to try to figure out what kind of experiment we would want to do by Friday. You know, you've got tons of time. And what experimental controls you will have for your experiment. Now remember, if we were to do this on Friday, the plan right now is in the morning session, we're going to do experiments effectively on each other. We won't record that, right? And we have to do it in such a way that it's ethical, meaning like, you're not going to take anybody's names, you don't have to do it, it's purely volunteer. If you want to stay out of it, that's fine. But we're going to basically be test subjects for each other's experiments. And I'm happy to do it too, as a test subject. But we have to do it in such a way we don't know who it was as best as we can. And we don't submit this to anyone, we don't publish it, we throw it away, right? It's a pilot on purpose. Does that make sense? Just by show of hands, how many people would be willing to participate in that? Okay, just remember, it is optional. Nobody has to do that, but this kind of procedure is an easy and ethical way that you can get some initial feedback on a study, right? Without having to go through a lot of complexity. Just ask a friend or two to look at it and go through it, that sort of thing. But so on Friday morning, we want to get our experiments good enough, and you might want to do some stuff at home to hone yours if you can, if you have the time this week, to get an experiment good enough that you could use it for a master's thesis or something else as like a starting point. Friday morning, we're going to do them, and then on Friday afternoon, we're going to run statistics on them. Right? Does that seem like a reasonable goal? To try to build ourselves up enough knowledge that we can do this stuff, and then Friday actually give it a shot with one of them, okay? So for the next 10 minutes, what I want you to do is figure out what an experiment's gonna be. You don't have to do it as an individual. Oftentimes you can do it as a group, so if your group wants to do just one, that's okay. If you as an individual want to just do one, that's okay too, right? But I don't want to necessarily I don't think it'd be feasible if we all did one individually, because that might be kind of nuts. But if you want to all do that, I'm cool with that too. So just decide what you want to do, and then we'll go from there. But remember, you're only going to have like an hour and a half to run all these experiments, so they have to be relatively short and not longitudinal. You can't test a hypothesis where you're like, what's the best first programming language? You just can't test that in an hour and a half. It's not possible. So that kind of a study is something that would take you multiple years to try to learn, and even then is probably not a very good research question anyway. But nonetheless, come up with something small and tangible. Like little syntax choices are not bad, little design decisions are not bad, things like that are good choices for a quick experiment. You with me? Okay, I'll keep the research questions up that we had so you can see what we thought of yesterday, but you don't have to use any of them. And then I'll give you 10 minutes, and then we'll go around the room as for what the experiments are, and I want you to think of what the experiment is and the controls that you think you'll need. This afternoon, we'll start banging out tasks. And then tomorrow, we'll do some more methodology. Okay, with me? Okay, 10 minutes. I know, 10 minutes to design an experiment isn't much.
Oh, well, and especially Thank you. how much he does in his example, is just get how he works the feedback. But that's you have a test symbol, but you should read the code and give you answer what's in there. You mentioned Thailand, and how you got to like global summit.
I love it. I think this is great. That's a good idea. Then you got three different styles. Okay, so I've got to be willing to, by Friday, start to come up with a design. If we publish it, we can do it together. Well, the whole point, and this is probably a big opening on that, no one's going to solve it. Okay, let's see. Okay, 2 minutes left. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I forgot my cord, so. Well, I mean, I forgot my adapter from US to your power system. There you go.
You have to flesh out what the three choices would be, and then we flesh out what the question is. That might be enough, right? I also feel like there's two things you want to flesh out. For this particular thing,
okay, let's go ahead and stop. In part because we only have 8 minutes left. So here's what I want to do. I just want to write down, if you're doing an experiment as a group, tell me that or not. Or if you're doing multiple, tell me that. And then we'll write down what our experiments are. And I'm going to do one too, because there's a question we've had in the lab for a while. And like, I want the stupid question answered, because my team is bloody argued about it forever, and I just want to know the damn answer. So, well, at least have pilot data on the answer. So let's start with you all again, and tell me what you got.
We talked to do it as a group.
Okay.
And showing everyone like maybe 3-4 snippets of code, preferably something that, if it exists, some language that everyone knows. And then there will be like mistakes in these codes and how long it took to correct those. And then we will also ask everyone how many languages they know. So to compare this time took and how many languages they knew. So it's the second one. Yeah.
So what are you varying in the experiment?
We're varying, we're not varying, but the number of languages that people know varies.
Mm.
And then the time it takes to correct these mistakes also varies. So we're comparing those two.
Okay. That's actually a tricky experiment to make. It will be kind of hard because there's a lot of complexity there that you might not realize yet. But nonetheless, my goal isn't to criticize or not. My goal is to write it down, and then we'll refine as we go.
Okay. But we have a second one version.
Do it. Mm.
We also ask how many languages they know.
Or like what they know, which ones
they know. And maybe the second question, also we...
So wait, hold on. This one is more like you want to understand whether people can comprehend.
Yeah. And after this comprehension, there's some examples of working.
Okay, there is a couple tests for comprehension. These are much more feasible.
Without examples and with examples.
Okay, with and without. Ah, I like that. That's interesting. There's a test I want you to look up if you have time. Now, I'm not assigning you formal homework, I swear. My goal, though, is to help you learn this stuff. So if I write down like an author or something to go look up, I'm trying to help you. But I'm not saying, thou shalt go read this and report back and do a book report for me, right? That's not what I'm saying. Does that make sense? There's a couple of famous papers by a woman named Nancy Pennington, and they're on program comprehension. If it helps you, feel free to look them up. It's not what you're doing, but it's relevant. So, did you get anything?
And then the other group, like, a sort of more complex syntax one with the same thing, essentially. And then have the middle one and see how fast they could, like, sort of find a bug in that one.
Okay. That's going to be tricky because simplicity and complexity is a very complicated thing.
Yeah.
However, there is data. So here's a couple things to think of as you're going. Number one is we did a syntax study from years ago, and if you want to do a syntax study, you should at least know how it works. And that one is, I don't remember the name of my own damn paper. This one. An empirical investigation to programming language syntax. And there is a number of techniques you can use in there that you can just copy them. And that will simplify you designing your experiment, right? You can see existing tasks and stuff like that. I'm not saying do the same experiment at all. Do whatever you want. I'm saying that, like, you don't have to start from scratch, right? Does that make sense? So on my personal webpage, it's number 24, apparently, so... Okay. That's good. I think that's an interesting one. Over here. Did you get one or no? And it's okay if you didn't. That's okay. Wait, added what?
Pipe operator.
Ah.
You can just...
into R?
In R.
Oh, okay.
It's not in the base, but it's like you can write a function or some, it's in some libraries, certain libraries. And the idea was just to use two snippets of code, one with this operator and another without that, and just randomize two groups and just give people to evaluate which is more readable for them, because it's supposed to make human readability easier of the code.
Okay, I love that idea. I love that idea. And here's why I love that idea. Number one, it's simple. You can do it in an hour and a half, right? You can design it this week, you can come up with some tasks, and you can do it. Number two, this kind of test is tangible, right? Like, You might argue about whether or not the pipe operator you find interesting or not. That's sort of a subjective thing. However, imagine in 30 years if a bunch of people had done 10,000 such tests, right? As a community, we did 10,000 tests on various kinds of operators. And all of a sudden, when you're designing a new language product, you can look it all up. Be like, oh, yeah, somebody did like 30 tests with that pipe and it didn't really work out, or it did work out. And, oh, 35 people did these tests on these very simplicity tests, and they did stuff like that. Oh, there's all this comprehension data over here. All of a sudden, we have an evidence-based community instead of asking ourselves, why is there only 22 studies to go on, right? There's nothing to look at. So I love this idea because it's simple, it's tangible, and we need like 100,000 more studies like it, right? So one, starting with one is good. So good idea. You seem skeptical. You're like, I thought it sucked, but okay, fine. So, anyway, in the back.
Hey, if your evidence is ending, how much can we have? I mean, the groups will guess what group they are in if you tell everything there.
Yeah, there's a problem.
That's okay. Then say what you can, but don't say the whole thing if it needs to be secret. This is a blinding issue, right?
Yeah,
sometimes you have to not know. Mm-hmm.
Let's say we will give a little code, part of code, to read for three test groups, and they will just read it through and say what it's meant to do.
Yeah, with a little twist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you say, though, what your hypothesis is here? What are you trying to find out?
No.
You can't say that without...
That's, yeah...
Okay. Well, at least tell me privately.
Yeah, we can tell you, because
mm-hmm.
then we don't. It's more
yeah, and that
know.
Means I wouldn't participate in the study. But remember, too, even if you get bad data from this group, that's okay, because the goal is a pilot, not the study. When you do a pilot, oftentimes you have to cheat a little bit like this, because you're getting feedback on the methodology, not on the result. So when you're done with Friday, the only conclusions you'll really be able to pull out are like, does my study suck, right? That's your goal. But you won't be able to say, what is the result of my study? That's usually what you do in a second pilot. So in our lab, we usually do, maybe I don't know if you know this or not, something called the doubling rule. You heard of this? Basically, when my students run an experiment in our lab, we have them do a pilot with one person. That's it, right? One person. And then that person inevitably says, I have no idea what the hell you're even talking about telling me to do. And then we do a study with two people, and then four, and then eight, and then 16. And we do that to build up whether the results are stable and whether they're replicating. And then eventually, we get up to a point where we feel like we have enough evidence, and we're not changing the study anymore, and we stop. And that's it. So it's sort of an old trick they use in psychology. It's not about trying to get your p-value low. It's about making sure that your study doesn't suck, that you're not seeing like any prop, like, you know, there wasn't a flaw, there wasn't like a bug in the test script, or just like problems with the study itself. So anyway, So don't if you reveal something and the results are all skewy, that's sort of okay. It's not that big of a deal. Just FYI. So, okay, but I'll write down that. So all groups are doing it as a group, probably, I assume. That's easier. So, okay. All right. Sounds good. So why don't we call it there? We'll come back at 1, and we're going to do the the 20th century of evidence, which is way different than the 19th and has very different lessons. So if you don't know that stuff, you'll want to because it's important. So the lessons that we learned in the 20th century are really critical. And unfortunately, while many scholars have learned the lessons of the 19th in computer science, almost nobody does follow conventions past 1918 in computer science, which is bonkers, but welcome to computer science. So, yeah, especially Stokes's cooperative research trial. But anyway, we'll talk about it. So see you at 1:00.